The Spectator magazine is home to wonderful writing, insightful analysis, and unrivaled books and arts reviews. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online. Alongside that, you get a £20 John Lewis or Waitrose voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Chinese Whispers with me, Cindy Yu. Every episode, I'll be talking to journalists, experts and longtime China watchers about the latest in Chinese politics, society and more. There'll be a smattering of history to catch you up on the background knowledge and some context as well. How do the Chinese see these issues? Last week, President Joe Biden finally signed into law a bill that would take TikTok off app stores in the US, eventually rendering the app obsolete there. Now, this is not the end of the story, as TikTok has vowed to take legal action against the bill. But, nevertheless, it is the latest development in the American decoupling from Chinese technology. In this episode, we'll be taking a look at the reverse trend, that is, the Chinese decoupling from American technology. It's a story that tends to go under the radar in light of bans and divestments from the US, but you might be surprised at how much China is cutting out American tech too, and doing it much more quietly. I'm joined by the journalist Lisa Lin, who has been following this story in her detailed coverage for the Wall Street Journal. She's also a co-author of the book Surveillance State, Inside China's Quest to Launch a New Era of Social Control. Lisa, welcome to Chinese Whispers. Now, can we start with Document 79, which you recently wrote about? It's quite blandly named, but interesting in content.
Thanks, Cindy. Thanks for having me. So Document 79 is this mysterious directive that has come from the Chinese regulator of the state-owned enterprises in the country. And this directive, which was passed out late 2022, basically instructed the state-linked sector to start shifting their procurement of all sorts of software that they were using in their tech infrastructure system and start moving them off foreign tech onto domestic alternatives. And the reason why I say it was a mysterious directive was because the people who were informed about the directive weren't allowed to make copies of the directive. Neither is the directive made public. So everything that we know about the directive is just from people who were told it, shown it, and then have passed the message on.
And you've spoken to those people. So what do we know about it?
So what we know is, you know, think about everything you use on your computer or your office laptop in a work setting, right? Your email client, if you were a business, the type of software that you used to manage clients, customers, manage your employees, manage your supply chain, all that sort of software has to be weaned off foreign vendors and you need domestic replacement for something like that. And everything from that to operating systems, for example. So instead of using a Microsoft Windows, you'd be using a Chinese alternative called Unity OS or Kailing OS. So things like these are on the chopping block.
That's so interesting because we obviously hear so much about this kind of tech decoupling happening from the American side. And I think it's very underreported what the Chinese side is doing with this. And this is coming after targeting hardware first, right? So the systems that you just mentioned is mainly software, but a similar trend has been happening in Western-made hardware too.
That's right. In a way, you know, it really started with hardware because it's much easier to move off Western-made hardware. The direction that China has been developing its economy is to become a manufacturing giant. So that meant anything that it could make, hardware stuff, the companies in China have become increasingly really good. Think about cell phones, for example. You know, China is the world's largest market for cell phones. And the bulk of the cell phones sold in China come from Chinese vendors. They've essentially mastered the art of making mass market cell phones. And as Huawei, one of its companies, has shown, you know, it's really starting to inch into the space that Apple and Samsung dominate on the high-end cell phone space. The reason why it was, you know, the localization directive, which was sweeping, was just more effective with hardware first, is because China simply made these things better. So anything from PCs, for example, you know, Lenovo is a Chinese brand, servers, a brand like Inspur or H3C, which might not ring a bell outside of China, but you know, inside of China, they're huge and a company like H3C would have actually originally started as a joint venture with Hewlett-Packard Enterprise. So it's really got all this tech know-how and the expertise in making hardware, which is why, you know, it was successful in hardware first.
Mm. And what's the evidence on the ground that this is happening? Because in your reporting at the Wall Street Journal, you've looked at some of the orders that these kind of government bodies are making. Can you tell us more about that? What you found in terms of actually how you know on the ground that this is happening?
Yeah, so this was the interesting part. I had noticed the localization push really accelerating 5 years ago. So just to give you some history, China has hoped to become self-sufficient in technology for decades now. Every 5 years, there is a five-year plan on the type of manufacturing that they want to excel in. And high-end technology and most technology has been on this list. But it really was only after the U.S. put Huawei on the entity list. And by being on entity list, Huawei was cut out from a lot of the advanced technology that American companies could provide. It's essentially an export control list. It was only after that happened that I saw an acceleration of orders popping up online. You know, local governments, state-owned enterprises, particularly in industries like finance, you know, financial institutions, telecom companies, power companies, the grid, all the industries that you expect would be more sensitive to China. I was seeing these web pages and statements pop up asking them or talking about a shifting their PCs and laptops from foreign-made vendors to domestic ones. So I was noticing this, but at the same time, it was so difficult to write the story because a self-sufficiency push and a localization push in China just isn't new. It was only, I think, last year that I was noticing market share changes, and you were seeing more and more companies in China and researchers talk about this localization push and how it's being enforced in a much more direct manner. With Document 79, what I forgot to mention was the Chinese were now putting in timelines. So the Chinese officials had asked companies for a clear timeline on how they were planning to wean off foreign technology. So it became a much more concerted, and in a way, I know this phrase is often overused, but all of nation push to get rid of foreign software.
But the examples that you mentioned are mainly also state-affiliated or state-owned companies. So how much of this is a private sector story? You know, the likes of Alibaba, for example, are they weaning themselves off of Western partners?
Yeah, so that's the really interesting part of this, right? With the private companies, businesses tend to make decisions on a very commercial level. So in a way, when they make decisions on a more commercial level, it's a bit more logical for us as bystanders to understand. So what I was noticing was in the Chinese businesses, you know, you really do see it go two ways. The people who are not in tech are still clinging on to Western technology. They still want their products running, for example, you know, going beyond software, they still want their products running on a tried and tested Intel or AMD chip. That's not something they want to change, and that's not something they want to bet their product reputation on. But what we're seeing with these businesses is while they're reluctant to shift, something's giving. So they're starting to parcel out more and more of their procurement to local vendors. So in the past, local vendors or local chip vendors in particular would never stand a chance with a Chinese cell phone maker. No Oppo or Xiaomi or Vivo. The names here are not representative, but no Chinese cell phone vendor wanted to stake their product's reputation on a Chinese chip. But what we're seeing now is Chinese hardware makers are starting to give these Chinese chip vendors a chance. They're starting to say, hey, you can have 10% of my procurement. Go ahead and try and adapt your chip to my product. And this chance is really all the chip vendors need, because if you understand the cycle of how chips work, it's just getting this chance to work with the product manufacturers to refine your product that gets you to prime time. So that's happening on the private company space. And when you look at the Chinese tech giants like Alibaba or Tencent or Huawei, they've kind of gone off in a different direction. I think Alibaba really started this localization push ages ago. I think it's got to be a decade ago with this campaign, which they call Qu, I-O-E, Qu being the Chinese term for getting rid of. And I-O-E was at that point IBM, Oracle, and EMC. I know these are names that we don't hear as much now, but at that point, Alibaba was just so reliant on these three companies for technology that they felt like they needed to develop their own alternatives. And now they've done that. They now have their own database software, they have their own servers, and everything is homegrown and home developed.
And you also came across this great phrase, delete A. Can you tell us about that? And also, what is it in Mandarin?
It wasn't in Mandarin. Delete A was something that a colleague of mine in China had stumbled upon when she had gone to a semiconductor exhibition. There was this big sign there and it says, you know, we want to delete A, like DEL/A. So just like the delete key on your keyboard.
Right, okay.
Essentially, they wanted to, in the Chinese semiconductor industry, wanted to help Chinese semiconductor makers. They were selling equipment and they're selling software. They wanted to help these semiconductor makers kind of get rid of Western equipment from their supply chain.
Yeah. So we've mentioned a few names already. And although you say that they're not household names, companies like IBM, people do know them as these giants in the very technical field of information technologies. What other companies are suffering? And give us an idea of the extent of the decline of their market share that you started noticing.
Yeah, so this is again when it gets a bit wonky, but that, I felt that was the best way to tell the tale of China's tech localization. So what I did was I looked at the market share changes in certain products. So in the database market, for example, back in the day in 2010, when a lot of databases were just physical servers, Oracle, IBM, Microsoft, they were the giants and they dominated China's database software market. Now, a lot of data is stored in the cloud, and the people who actually store this data and run the software to help you organize and sort through massive amounts of information, it's Alibaba and Huawei. So you're definitely seeing a very clear shift there. And a company like HPE, for example, that makes servers, Hewlett-Packard Enterprise had about 14% of its revenue coming from China a decade ago. And then now it's down to a fraction of that. And beyond that, I think we're seeing a lot more signs on the wall. And it's really just more circumstantial evidence proving the point that localization is hitting foreign companies. We saw Salesforce, we saw Citrix, Adobe. These are recognizable software names, especially in business software outside of China. They've been downsizing their operations in the country over the last couple of years, firing staff or just closing certain parts of their operation. So these are the things that you're really seeing. And if you went through government procurement documents, you're noticing as well a big push to buy local. And these are spelled out in the standards of that procurement document, the technical specifications they want the vendor to provide.
How will they specify that? Will they just say, we want indigenous or Chinese companies to do these things? Is that how they do it?
So actually how it works in practice, and it really varies from province to province and from department to department, but typically what they say is, you know, we want to buy rack servers, for example, and they'll give you three or four brands that they would want to purchase from. So in the case of hardware, it might be, in the past, it would have been Lenovo, IBM, Hewlett-Packard. And then fast forward to 2023, it would be a Chinese brand such as Inspur.
Right.
And for chips, and this has been widely reported as well, for chips, last December, the MIIT, which is the Ministry of Industry and Information Technology in China, they put out certain procurement standards. It was, you know, an array of options of the type of processors you could use, CPUs in general, that you could use for your desktop and your laptop computers. And out of the eight options, two options were foreign. They were right at the end of the list. And if you wanted to use those options, you know, there's like that fine print that says, if we want to pick these two options, you have to go through extra checks and clearances first, which is, I think, a deterrent in itself.
Yeah. Well, Lisa, let's talk about why it's happening then, because I'm sure that's the question on many listeners' minds right now. It seems to me that there's probably a lot of different factors in here, but one factor is the fact that these Chinese companies have become a bit better at supporting the digital ecosystem. You know, Alibaba, the fact that it's no longer an e-commerce platform, it's also got its own cloud computing. You know, that's quite new to me. That's quite incredible. And also companies like Huawei making their own chips in a way that they didn't 5 or 10 years ago. So can you talk a little bit about that? How much the Chinese side has got better? And I guess a follow-up question to it is, how much of that has come from Western partnerships that our listeners will be caring about? You know, we talk about these localization drives where the companies did have local partners before. So are they learning from the Western partners?
Undoubtedly, Chinese tech products have become a lot better than where they were a decade ago. They're enterprise software, and you know, they're good for multiple reasons. Not just from the workability, but also just adapting to the way the Chinese tech ecosystem works. So for example, enterprise software, right? You have your giants such as SAP, that would be, or Oracle, that's helping with enterprise software. But a company in China, you know, China's enterprise software giant, so to speak, which is not used anywhere else in the world, but in China, they're trying to expand, but you know, it's really in China that they've got traction. Their enterprise software is tailored to adapting to WeChat, which is a messaging system in China that virtually everybody does business on. If you are a foreign vendor, it's very difficult to adapt your software, or it's an additional hurdle to adapt your software to accommodate something like that. But this is what the Chinese vendors do. They are scoring well on just the workability front now, and also, you know, their products are now tailor-made to the Chinese market, and that makes them so attractive.
But in your reporting, you've also found that sometimes they don't actually come up to scratch compared to their Western competitors. So then let's talk about the other factors that this is happening. What do you think are the main political reasons?
Yeah, so I guess because technology is such a broad catch-all term, it's everything from chips to software to hardware. So obviously in software, they've been making some strides, but in areas such as chips, and in particularly high-end chips, we're quite certain that at this point, even though Huawei is able to make enough high-end chips to sell or commercially produce a high-end smartphone, there are a lot of doubts globally about how sustainable that is. And to that, you know, we really don't have an answer, and China hasn't like openly said anything either.
Sustainable, but in what way? In terms of like being able to scale up, or sustainable in terms of the tech growth? Or what do you mean by that?
I think it would be both, just in scaling up. So for example, you know, when the US put the export control on Huawei, it blocked Huawei from what is widely seen as the world's best and largest foundry, which is TSMC. So with chip production, you know, or the entire cycle of chip making and chip production involves not just chip designing, which is what Huawei is very good at, but you also need to produce these chips. And most companies now have gravitated towards either just doing one part of the cycle. So you're either chip designing, you're chip producing, or you're chip testing, which is right at the end. So Huawei has all along been recognized as China's best chip designer. And now they have these chip designs that just can't be reproduced. They can't be reproduced by TSMC. They've managed to find a way to reproduce them or produce them in China, but in a small scale. And we don't know how many chips they can produce in one batch, but from what is out there, Huawei can do it, but in very limited quantities. Then going beyond making the current existing high-end chips, because chip making is a constant race. Everyone's racing, you know, trying to make the smallest chip, competing. Yeah. And it's Moore's law, basically. Who can squeeze the most transistors on like a small piece of silicon? And to do that, to get even further from where we are at this point, or where Huawei is at this point, they need these really specialized machines of EUV technology, of which is controlled by a Dutch company, and that Dutch company cannot sell to China anymore. So Huawei is facing bottlenecks in a few directions, and it's not just scaling up production, but it's actually going beyond what they actually have.
Yeah, well, so I sidetracked you there from my earlier question, which is about the political reasons why it's happening. So I guess from your answer, it's already clear that one reason it's happening is because Americans are doing it, and Chinese companies sometimes have no choice but to think about resilience.
So I think in terms of why China is doing this and pushing ahead with localization, I mean, the broad umbrella overarching reason is national security. And I have to take you back to maybe a decade ago, I think it was 2013, when Edward Snowden came out and exposed that the U.S. National Security Agency had infiltrated Chinese networks, the Chinese networks of Huawei, some of its most prestigious defense and, you know, elite academic institutions. And China doesn't want that to happen again. And the reason why they felt the U.S. was able to do it was because the backbone of their tech infrastructure then was Western.
Mm.
So, you know, just on that basis, they've always already wanted to get American technology out. And then on top of that, you have Trump waging a trade war and then cutting Huawei off from GPUs, x86 chips, all the high-end stuff. And if you remember, although it doesn't seem so obvious now, but Huawei, after its entity listing, they had gone quiet for a while. They went from a company that was going to overtake Samsung as the world's largest cell phone maker to selling off their mass market cell phone business. So they really had crippled Huawei for a couple of years, and China really doesn't want that to happen to them as a country.
Right. So two factors then. One is that using American systems and American hardware raised fears of backdoors from the US into China, with these fears that we hear so much about in the other direction. But the Chinese are also afraid. And as you say, Edward Snowden leaked some documents that suggested that was happening. And then the second thing is building resilience in the system in case something like Huawei happens again to other sectors. Is that right?
That's right. The Huawei incident showed where the US had a chokehold on China. And China really, really wants to make sure it never gets put in that position again. Mm. Not with Huawei, not with any other company.
I mean, I just find this so interesting because this story, as I've said, is one that we hear so often from one side, from the Western side, in terms of worries about Chinese backdoors, but also worries about Chinese spying and ways in which we want to, you know, kind of cut Chinese companies out. But I think the reverse side of that, American spying on China or America's export bans that limit Chinese tech, reasons to make the Chinese think that they are being contained economically and technologically by Americans is something that we don't hear so much about, which is why I find your reporting on this so valuable. But when it comes to this export ban, Lisa, what about the controls on Huawei then? Because as you say, it crippled the company for a few years, but then Huawei seems to have managed to rise out of the ashes, as it were. Have the controls worked?
Yeah, so that is a question that's really up for debate because it really depends, right? Were US controls meant to just shut Huawei out of its telecom networks and the telecom networks of its allies? Or were the US controls there to cripple Huawei? And if you really go by the book, I don't think it was there to cripple Huawei. It was just Huawei was a national security threat and we don't want them in our telecom system or in our networks or our allies' telecom networks. You know, the jury is still out, but what we've definitely seen is that Huawei, after the entity list, went quiet for a couple of years. And it was just last month where they reported that their profit in 2023 had doubled. And they ascribed it to better demand for their high-end cell phones, better demand for their telecommunication equipment, and better demand for the enterprise software that they had now developed. Because in the past, you know, they might have been using Oracle or IBM, and they had to build from scratch software that they could use internally and not rely on the West. And while they did so, they also stumbled on a new business driver and a business opportunity because now they have, you know, enterprise software to sell and you have a Chinese government willing to buy it. So for Huawei, it's been really a confluence of a lot of very pleasant surprises that happened in their favor.
Yeah, absolutely. And then on the cell phone one, there was obviously that recent reporting as well that some Chinese government ministries are asking their staff to use Huawei phones and not iPhones.
That's right. So I think this is also an extension of this whole national security push. You've seen that happen not just with iPhones, you've also seen that happen with like Tesla cars, for example. So you've seen reporting, I think, over the last couple of years showing that Tesla cars are increasingly blocked from entering anywhere that, for example, Chinese President Xi Jinping might have been in an area, and just within that area for a couple of days, you don't see any Tesla cars being allowed in, not in any sensitive installation, for example, like a military installation or a military base.
Yeah. And where does that leave people like Elon Musk or Bill Gates, for example, at the top of Tesla and Microsoft, these tech entrepreneurs in the West who seem so friendly with the Chinese. I mean, Bill Gates was one of the first people to meet Xi Jinping after the zero COVID years and China had opened up. Are they still hoping, holding out, that their companies might do better in China? Or do you think that that's a false hope, that the Chinese, the political calculus is so much that it kind of just dictates the trends against them?
So I think it's a very polarizing debate on how to view these people. And the very, very commonly seen and held view is that, especially in DC, where the topic of like China is so toxic, the commonly held view is these people shouldn't be doing it. They're bending over backwards for the Chinese. I see why there are people who are supporting that view, but my own personal view is that, you know, they're bridge builders. And at this point, the US and China needs these group of bridge builders, because if they're not there, then miscommunications can become much bigger miscommunications, and it can just spiral into something that's a lot worse on the geopolitical front. But for businesses, generally, for tech companies like Microsoft, and just for your information, Microsoft only gets 1.5% of its revenue, total global revenue, from China, which shows you how small they are in the market, even though China is a huge market.
But that's been in decline, hasn't it? It used to be much bigger as a share of their global revenues.
It used to be bigger, but it was never that huge, because China was a huge counterfeit market for Microsoft.
Yeah.
So even though Microsoft was used, piracy was involved, so a lot of pirated versions were used as well. So they were never able to cash out in the market that the way people envision.
I see. And that brings me to my next question, Lisa, which is, as a strategic move, what do you think about all of this tech decoupling? As we've talked about, it's happening from both directions. Is it that, as I've heard some people say, you know, good fences make good neighbours? So, you know, if you actually cut reliance from both directions, then actually that makes your debate about your relation, bilateral relations, less toxic? Or is it that actually by separating your internet, your digital systems more and more, by bifurcating that, you're actually creating more chances of conflict? I mean, I don't know if you have a view on that question. It's a really big one.
So maybe something that I should have mentioned a bit earlier as well. It does seem like the US was the antagonistic party in this US-China tech decoupling. But you have to realize that China locked out American consumer internet companies and social media companies way before the US called ZTE and Huawei national security threats in their telecom infrastructure. I remember moving to China in 2010. I am not based there now for reasons that would be difficult to elaborate. But, you know, moving to China in 2010 as a consumer and wanting to access Google, wanting to access Facebook, it was just impossible. You got a 404. You know, it's a broken link. The way you had to access these sites, Twitter included, was to get a VPN, a virtual private network that would allow you to disguise your IP and pretend that you weren't physically in China. And that's how you were able to jump the Great Firewall to get onto these websites. And it was this sort of techno-nationalism and protectionism that allowed, I think, WeChat and a lot of, you know, Weibo and all these other Chinese companies to thrive.
Yeah. Well, not least because they could copy the successful models of their Western competitors without actually competing with them inside China.
Precisely. So it was a walled garden, and the Chinese companies were allowed to run free rein without the foreign competitors there trying to eat the lunch. That's not to say that the Chinese companies themselves were not subject to competition, because China is a very competitive market, and within Chinese tech companies, it is very competitive as well. But it did give them the breathing room to expand and also develop into the huge players that Alibaba, Tencent, and Baidu are today. So I think we need to recognize that. And having said that, I just want to say that from a consumer standpoint, tech decoupling is troublesome. Because what that meant was you had a splinter net. Every time you were in China, if you had to go on an online shopping platform, it wasn't Amazon. If you had to hail a car, it wasn't Uber. It was going to be Didi. It was going to be Alibaba. And if you needed a map, you know, you couldn't just use Google Maps. You needed a Baidu map or AMAP, which is run by Alibaba. And once you get outside of China, it's a different ecosystem you have to get adjusted to. That is peanuts, because, you know, that's just for the consumer and it's like a regular inconvenience. I think it's a much bigger issue, tech decoupling, for businesses. Because for businesses, what they're up against is they have a much higher level of compliance now. If you were, you know, an Intel or AMD or NVIDIA, and you are not allowed to sell your high-end chips to China, you had to invest that extra time and energy and money to figure out where your chips are going, how you can avoid selling chips to the wrong party. So there's that extra layer of trouble that just comes with export controls and tech decoupling, not to mention these companies and a lot of other companies have to go to the US government and ask for permission to sell certain products to China. You know, it's just added layer of trouble. That said, I think the advocates for tech decoupling, they often use national security as the reasons, and you really can't put a price on national security. So I think my view on this is we just have to get used to tech decoupling globally, as I don't see anything stopping the steamroller.
But I guess the question is, does it actually help national security to have this kind of splinter net, as you describe it? Because it maybe minimizes the amount of things you have to argue over. It minimizes the opportunities for the other side to spy on you or to take your economic market share. But it also means that you have less of a stake in each other. It becomes more of a Cold War situation when one feels. But I don't know, does it actually help national security?
Man, that's a tough one.
Yeah, I don't know if the people in charge really know.
Yeah, I mean, I think it gives them some psychological comfort, knowing that at least our databases are separate. And it is harder, especially in the age where cyber hacking is so prevalent, it is harder for one party to get into the other. And hopefully, you know, it will pay off if eventually China or the US feels like they're both so isolated from each other's networks and so cut off that they can trust each other again.
Yeah. And I guess the jury's still out because we've never really been in this situation geopolitically before. The Cold War comparison isn't good because the USSR relationship with the Americans was so different. So yeah, I guess we'll find out in the next few years what this will be like. Lisa Lin, thank you so much for joining Chinese Whispers.
Thanks a lot, Cindy.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Chinese Whispers. Now, if you're a fan of what we do here on the show, you should come along to an exclusive Chinese wine lunch from The Spectator in June. It'll be hosted by Janet Wang, author of The Chinese Wine Renaissance. You might remember hearing her on the podcast a couple of years ago discussing Chinese wines, and our drinks editor, Johnny Ray. I'll also be there, and together we'll be tasting some of China's most remarkable wines. To find out more and get tickets, go to spectator.co.uk/Chinese wine.